This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. Today's innovations are tomorrow's possibilities. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
You know, Eric, we've never actually talked that much about revenue in the ETF industry. And Bloomberg Intelligence recently did some research about this.
Yeah. One of the things we love to look at is assets. And then, of course, your market share and where you rank in assets.
No, all of that stuff. Everybody wants assets. We talk about that all the time.
Totally. But then when you compare it to like revenue and revenue share and revenue rank, you get a different order of firms. Like Vanguard slides down the list in revenue. Other firms that sell leverage products, they go up. It's really interesting. But to me, this is so useful for our clients and when we write, because everyone's trying to deal with this new ETF pterodome, as we call it, because it's where all the fish are biting, but they're very picky and they love cheap. So how can you make money? And so by studying who can actually make more money than their assets allow and vice versa and how that works, it can help firms figure out where to launch products and how to price them.
Athanasios Serafagos at Bloomberg Intelligence, who's an analyst, he's written some of this research, right?
Yeah. Of the whole team, I think Ethan is, he's like a, you ever heard of that term, a musician's musician? Like a band that like a lot of, like Velvet Underground. He is really good at surprising the team with research. So I think he's like an analyst. And when he does these deep dives, I'm always like, wow. And like usually he has like two or three charts in there or data points that blow my mind. And, you know, I live and breathe this stuff. So this was one of those studies I thought had a lot of good nuggets like that, that he unearthed.
So joining us, Athanasios Serafagos of Bloomberg Intelligence, and also Katie Greyfield of Bloomberg News, who's also the co-host of the new Money Stuff podcast. This time on Trillions, what pays the bills? Athanasios, Katie, welcome back to Trillions.
Thanks for having me. I mean, after that Athanasios intro, I'm expecting
a musician's musician, right? Athanasios, what music do you actually play?
Well, I don't play any instruments.
Just analyst.
I don't know.
Music.
Like, does the terminal count as an instrument?
Yeah, you just totally. Play the terminal, baby.
It's all the different like, colored keys like a, and yeah, works out well.
Making like a keyboard. Sweet music on the Bloomberg. So
he's into like house music.
Deep house. Like progressive house.
Yeah, like he likes tight, DJs and that kind bill. Of thing.
Brooklyn warehouses.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, that tracks.
Athanasios.
Outlaw parties, after hours parties. Where Ethan hangs out, the place doesn't, quote, get good till like 3:30 in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, Athanasios, what did you set out to unearth with your research here?
You know what actually inspired this was an article you had written about the Fidelity.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's because, you know, we cover it for a while and it's great for the investor, but at the end of the day, someone needs to make money, right? Like in order to keep these products coming, all this innovation, it needs to be funded somehow. While it's great for the investor, say like Vanguard funds for 3 basis points, when you look at what are the firms that are making money? It's actually really, really interesting. For example, like First Trust.
It's hard to make a buck, right? That's the big takeaway here.
Yeah. I mean, just even in context, you make way less money than you do, let's say, in the mutual fund industry. So you're already sort of downshifting into a more cost competitive landscape. And it's kind of interesting. Like what I saw was like First Trust, for example, it has just a fraction of the assets of Vanguard, makes just as much as they do, right? So basically, we're just trying to identify that there are pockets that you can make some money. It's not just you're going to launch an ETF, you're going to launch it for a couple of basis points, and you're not going to make any money. There are some pockets that there is a potential to make some decent money.
So Katie, did you know that you're the muse for this episode?
The musician's musician's muse.
Yeah, I like that.
Wow, triple M. So the story in question Myself and Emily Grafea, we saw a document that showed that Fidelity is going to impose a new fee on ETFs issued by 9 firms, was the list that we saw. And basically, it's because those firms didn't agree to participate in a maintenance arrangement with Fidelity in which they would pay Fidelity. And as a result, basically investors in those products, so investors going to Fidelity's platform trying to buy ETFs from those firms, would then be faced with a $100 servicing charge. So basically trading wouldn't be free anymore. Mm. So you think about that. You think about the size of trades that's being made on the platform. If you wanted to buy $25 worth of shares of Simplify, for example, was on the initial list that we saw, you'd have to pay $100 on top of that, which is just really large.
Right. Some friction there.
Yeah.
And let me give some other scale to that, because I wrote a piece on your piece too, Katie, which my reaction was, I don't know if the optics are worth this tiny bit of revenue they're going to get, because let me give you some numbers that just show how little ETFs make versus the mutual funds. So ETF's total revenue, and this is an eighth in story, is $15 billion a year. Pretty good. Sounds like a lot. But mutual funds will be north of $100 billion. And Fidelity alone makes $28 billion. So Fidelity makes two ETF industries itself. And this is a little reason why it rubs some of the issuers the wrong way. It's like, hey, you make so much money. We're just like fighting for scraps here. Why do you have to hurt us little guys just trying to get, you know, get something going? And this became, you know, kind of a controversial issue, which Katie's scoop, I think, kicked off. We'll see how it plays out, but I get both sides.
I mean, it was a scoop, just for the record.
What did I say?
Kind of scoop? You said a scoop, I think. so I'm just confirming. But no, it definitely kicked off just a firestorm of discussion on Twitter, for example. And apparently it inspired some great research as well. Bring it back.
Yeah, bring it back to Athanasios coming in late there. So what did we learn?
Well, you're going to make less money, but like Eric quoted, it's $15 billion. But that number is going to keep going up because funds are converting. Everything is going towards there. So yes, you can keep milking the money in the mutual fund industry as long as the market keeps going up. But what anyone who wants to jump into the industry, you just need to realize like there's ways you can make money, right? And it's not just you're going to go to ETFs and you're going to turn into Vanguard and there's no more money. So I think it's important to look at like where some of the money is coming from. Like active is actually a really big one, right? And I think this is where there's always a lot of hesitation. Active managers don't want to convert into ETFs, but active pays a lot of the bills, right? And so I think about active might be about 7% of the assets, but it's almost a fifth of the revenue. That's massive, right? But I think it's also good that Vanguard is getting bigger, right? And this is something Eric has talked about a lot in the past. Like, the bigger they get and the more you're saving your investors in sort of their core portion of the portfolio, you have some money to play around with. So you become less cost insensitive. You could go to thematics, you could go to buffer ETFs or active, right? So you can see that some of these funds are charging quite a bit of money. But again, that plays in with the Vanguard growth. You know, thematics make quite a bit of money too. And so you see it in the trends of the new launches. Anyone that's launching a new product, they're trying to get creative. They're using options or they're doing themes or active because that's a place that's making some decent money. It's probably the only place you can still make some money too.
So break down the money because, I mean, the big three, how much money are they actually raking in?
Yeah, less than half, but they have 75% of the assets, right? Which is amazing. I think that's a good sign for the smaller guys where I think a lot of the innovation comes from. And again, Vanguard really pulls that average down. They don't make like any money. I mean, they're essentially almost like a charity.
Can I tell you how much money they make from your table?
Yeah,
because
please.
This really, I did a double take. Vanguard has about $2.5 trillion in ETF assets. And according to Athanasios' research, they make $1.3 billion in annual revenue. I mean, that is shocking to me.
It seems so little, right?
Yeah.
What they do.
Yeah, so let me just expand on that because on percentage terms, so they have 29% of the assets, but they make 9% of the revenue. But when I wrote the Bogle book, I looked at all funds. When you bring in mutual funds, that gap gets crazier. It's more like 27%, but 5% because mutual funds have so many gigantic revenue generating funds. But That gap is absurd. I mean, there's nothing even close to it. BlackRock, for example, has 31% of the assets, but 28% of the revenue. So they're almost like one for one. But clearly, like, even they're making a little less than their asset share.
Okay. So if you're not those big three, what do those numbers look like?
So I'd say ones that really stick out. First Trust is making quite a bit of money because their average fee is something like 78 basis points. The other thing is leveraged ETFs. So the pro shares, the directions. I think TQQ is number five on the list of the highest revenue generating ETF, right? It's 20 or so billion in assets at 95 basis points. So leverage, thematics, active, all tend to make quite a bit of money. And then anything over 60 basis points, like, which seems like it's insane. Like, how can I sell an ETF that's over 50 or 60 basis points? But money's going there. They make up a third or so of the revenue. So I feel like when you pull it back and you look at it, it shouldn't dissuade someone from launching new product. There is ways to make money. It's not just you're going head to head with Vanguard. I think if you're getting innovative, right? If you're going to launch another S&P 500 ETF, you can't charge more than 3 basis points. Like, there's not money to be made there, but there are some pockets. I think if you get creative, there's some potential that you can make some money.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's been this race to the bottom for almost as long as we've been doing this podcast. But when you start talking 50 or 60 basis points, that is kind of a new number, right? So is this a new trend that's emerging, or is it just doubling down on things that have worked for the past couple of years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you're unique enough, you can charge more for it. And I think, like, Cathie Wood really exposed that, right? If you're really unique, it's something that no one else offers. But I don't know, it's like, is Vanguard going to get so cheap that eventually just, like, swallows itself whole and we start all over again, right? Because now there's single stock ETFs and whatnot. So I feel like we've gone so far to one end that it's now swinging back over. And I think when you look at it, total cost of ownership, right? So, like, you're not going to be 100% in an ARK. So if you sort of look at it in the context of your whole portfolio, sort of weighted average cost, you're still lower, right? You have your Vanguard allocation, your thematics, your actives. You're still saving money as an investor. So I think if it's unique enough, like, you're not going to launch an S&P 500 ETF at 50 basis points. It's just not going to sell. But I think if it's really something unique, it could be done. It's shown that it could be done. I think buffers are a really interesting case study too. They're very unique. They got something like $40 billion or so in assets. And they're pretty decent, like, revenue generators for the industry.
Katie, do you know what the top revenue-generating ETF is?
I mean, is it GBTC at this point? Or is it GLD? It's something like that.
You're close.
Oh, my God. I feel like I should know this.
Those are 3 and 4.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, good guesses. Yeah.
You're close.
It's not the Q's.
Yes.
It's still the Q's?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, according to Athanasios' research.
One of my favorite things.
Yeah, that's why I was going to, you know, volley it to you.
We're all just stepping all over each other. Yeah, the Q's is amazing. I forget what the fee is. It's like 20 basis points, right? Yeah. 20 basis points.
And that's because of that old trust structure.
Yeah, unit investment trust, yeah. Which means that Invesco virtually sees none of that money. It's sort of like this piggy bank that they can't crack. SPY is a similar thing, and SPY is 9 basis points, and it's enormous. So I have to imagine it's on that list
number
as well.
Number two.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. So, but more, some of that money stays in the door at State Street, I believe, because they're the custodian, correct?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Yeah.
It's also wonky.
Velvet Underground over so, there.
Yeah. It's so wonky. Okay, so if you look at this, that list that you put together, Athanasios, like, what's the big surprise on there?
Oh, yeah. So we looked at the top 30 revenue-generating ETFs. So ones that really stuck out, JEPI from JP Morgan cracked the list. COWS from Pacer cracked the list. Moat from Van Eck, which really shocked me. So there were these really interesting ones. I'm like, I had to double check. I'm like, wow, all of a sudden these names started getting pulled up to the
kind
top.
Kind of some indies in there, right?
Yeah, like, for sure.
Yeah.
GBTC is on the list. You had mentioned that's a conversion. So when you look at it, you're like, wow, there's actually a TQQQ, which is like number 5. So, but they have something in common, right? They're all very different. They're smart beta, or they're leveraged, or active, or thematic. And again, these are at the top of the list. So yeah, that one, those ones definitely stuck out the most. And Q was always number 2 for a long time behind SPY, and it just only kind of recently had taken the top spot.
I will say what we're describing now, and like you say, that issuers are looking more towards active thematics, et cetera, as a way to make money. It sort of puts what issuers always tell us in more of a pessimistic light, because, I mean, we, especially on ETF IQ, we talk to a lot of issuers, you know, coming out with active products, et cetera. And they say, you know, we're responding to client demand. Client demand, it's always client demand. But it's also just a way to pay the bills.
Pay those bills.
Yeah, I think JEPI is interesting here, and CALS. These two, I think, should be somewhat a blueprint for how active can survive going forward. I think CALS is like, hey, let's just take this one metric, cash flow. And it came out like 3 years and nobody cared. But then when the Fed raised rates, cash flow became like a big deal. And that is on the top 20. And JEPI, to me, JP Morgan, we just covered this on ETF IQ also. Brian Lake just moved from JP Morgan to Goldman. And he was, I thought, turned picking expense ratios into an art form, because JEPI is 35 basis points, right? So it's not dirt cheap, but it's cheap enough where as an advisor, you're like, okay, it's got JP Morgan's brand name. It's a covered call strategy. So they're doing this legwork of like options they have to sort of like keep up with. Then there's a fundamental screen in there and it's 35 basis points. It feels fair. And this is, again, now in the top 20 revenue generating. So what he did is made, I think, everybody feel like they got a fair deal for active while at the same time making good money. And so I would definitely study, if I was coming out with ETFs, I'd study JEPI. And then on the flip side, I'd study like an ARK or a thematic ETF. So if you have a lot of active share, I think you can charge more. TQQQ in the top 5 is also interesting. Ethan and I frequently joke about the leverage issuers because they have to be the envy of the industry, because Vanguard will never deal with them. They take a little crap from people online. It's like they're selling like
those analysts who have like a red light rating system and all.
Yeah. People are like, you know, what is the social purpose of triple leverage this? But
the social purpose.
I mean, they really have, you know, or is this too dangerous? They definitely, every now and then, they just kind of get kicked around. But they make a nice little living. They account for 5-6% of the revenue, even though it's like 1% of the assets. And that, you know, it's the trading tools.
I was going to say,
I do think there's a polarization.
It feels like there's this existential thing that's happening where it's like, okay, super tidy, vanilla, low-cost things, and then assortment of trading tools that, you know, you have to pay for, and not a small amount anymore.
No, I think that's
but enough for people to make a living.
Yeah. I think either you're going to shop at Walmart or like the really boutique shop, right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. You're going to buy all your essentials there and then the specialized stuff. And you're willing to pay for it, right? And it seems like that's where the industry is splitting. When we look at launches by fee, the fees are actually going up on average, right? Mm. And so They're, you know, launches will follow the money, people willing to pay for it, and you're offering something unique. The flows are going to go there, and it's showing, at least so far.
The death of the
middle
class.
Another term.
there you go.
Joel, we have another term that we call package adrenaline. Like, if you can make somebody feel something, and I would put the leveraged single stock ETFs in there, people will pay. There's like no price sensitivity out there. Like the double leveraged NVIDIA ETF is $2 billion. It charges 1.1% in fees. No advisor would ever pay that much for fees, but they would never use this anyway. This is purely for like gambling, really. But I mean, I'm okay with it as long as you know what, you know, you use it short term and you know you're kind of gambling. That's a very ironic situation where the bigger Vanguard and passive gets, the kind of crazier and more exotic we're going to see new ETF launches get. So it's ironic, but it makes sense if you think about it.
I will say something that's interesting to me is like what this means for issuers beyond what sort of strategies that they might launch into, because there was this Citi report from last year. I wrote it up in October 2023, so it probably came out a little before then. But they found that roughly one third to half of U.S. listed ETFs right now can't cover their annual operating costs. And you think about this big uptick that we've seen in ETF closures. And I'm wondering if this sort of dynamic and also what we're describing right now will keep those closures at this high level. I think it wasn't quite record closures last year, but it was pretty close. At the same time that you had almost record launches.
And there's record closures this year too. They're on pace to have a record.
Yeah.
So
I think the churn will be
agree, but
we'll see you in October again for the ETF graveyard episode.
Spooky.
Well, for every 2x NVIDIA that's a $2 billion hit, there's like five of them that like nobody touched. So some of these hot sauce products is spaghetti at the wall.
And Inverse Cramer like ended something up being one of those, right?
Yep.
You guys did a whole episode on that.
As we should have.
Yes.
I wrote about how that was the right idea, but the wrong design. They should have made it long short.
Mm.
They needed to make it just one direction because it kept offsetting. So to Ethan's point, you got to be cheap or shiny. And the Cramer was, the way it was designed, it could never get shiny.
Sometimes the stars just align. Like, it's just a formula that hopefully is like, okay, where's the money going? It's going to active. People are willing to pay. Issuers are going to try it. But a lot of them are going to fail too, right? There's just normal churn in the industry. Someone might take it too far. They might get a little too crazy, you know. But at least this gives you a blueprint of like what might be working and what areas should an issuer be looking to launch in.
To your point, Eric, you were saying JEPI perhaps will provide a blueprint to other issuers looking to launch active. A lot of issuers took that literally and just sort of came out with JEPI copycats. And it's interesting that those haven't done too well. I mean, you think about some of the big names, I believe BlackRock, Goldman, for example, who just tapped Brian Lake. They haven't exactly been able to replicate what we're seeing with JEPI.
Yeah, it's kind of like ARK, right? After ARK was a hit, everybody came out with their innovation or disruptors ETF, and none of them really took in that much money. But they, some were over 100 million. I mean, you know, eked out a little bit of a profit. I think with JEPI, this trade is so popular, which is the covered call trade, that if you have a salesperson going to meet advisors, you kind of need a JEPI product in your toolbox. So I think they have it there just so they have something and don't have to like refer to the person to JP Morgan. But I'm with you. Really, the innovator definitely gets most of the spoil. And that's how it should be, I think. But there's a lesson just in JEPI in general, which is a brand name with some legwork and a moderate fee. Forget if it's covered call. Think of something else. That it's that spirit, it's that logic that I think is what could be successful. Not doing another JEPI, but just doing something that balances all that in a way that an advisor can be like feeling like they're being fiduciary and not paying too much. Because obviously, I think over the years, they felt like they paid too much for somebody to pick stocks and underperform.
Okay, so all of this just makes me think of David Einhorn a little bit, who has said some spicy things about passive investing this year. There's been some ongoing coverage, including recently from Bloomberg News and our colleague Lu Wang there that dove into some of that. Ethan, you came up in there because one of the things that, I mean, basically Einhorn feels like passive is destroying stock market value, has been crushed. But you think he's overstepped slightly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's Einhorn. I think it's a lot of people, right? Every couple of years, we got to deal with this. They come out with some thing about passive distorting markets. So we looked at it. We looked at all the stocks based on their passive ownership. And just to give you context, right? If you take mutual funds and ETFs together, they own about 24% of the stock market, and only half of that is passive. So again, a pretty small number. But then we looked at stocks with higher and lower passive ownership, and we found that stocks with lower passive ownership performed better than ones with higher passive ownership. And the critics always say, well, the main premise was that stocks with higher passive ownership, they get inflated up artificially, they tend to be more volatile during drawdowns, things like that. We didn't find anything meaningful from the data that would support that. I'm not saying that passive isn't a thing, right? It may be in some stocks, but overall, the data kind of refuted a lot of the stuff that they've been saying for a while.
And just to be clear, what this is the S&P 500 stocks, there's 500 of them. The ones that have the least amount of their shares owned by passive actually had the best performance. That kind of goes against this idea that like the stocks that do the best are the ones that index funds own the most of.
Was that surprising? I mean, like that, it sounds like when you actually dig it up, it's like, whoa, that's like, yeah, we haven't talked about that before.
It was. And it seems like if you're active, I would have taken this as a good thing. You're like, wait, there's opportunities. There's stocks that are lower passively owned. There's more opportunity for me. They perform better. Like, I feel like that's a good thing. That's giving you more ammo on a portfolio management side. And then, you know, we even looked at things like additions and deletions from the S&P. Deletions ended up doing better than the additions and vice versa. Like, I think even the fact that there are additions and deletions to the S&P refutes all that, right? Because if your argument is, if it's in the S&P, passive's going to push it up, none of these stocks should ever drop out of the S&P. They should just all keep going up. Mm-hmm. So the fact that that even exists sort of like goes against the premise of some of these arguments.
And you said that you got a lot of hate mail?
Yeah, good and bad. Some people, you know, got, as you can imagine, it's a pretty touchy thing. Now you see, like, you know, there's been podcasts now off of this and a couple articles. Yeah, it's very touchy, especially, you know, for active managers because the performance rates have not been great, right? Mm. So a lot of them can blame the S&P. But I still don't see, like, Apple being propped up because it's, you know, the second biggest stock in the S&P. Like,
Apple's also underperformed this year,
yeah, exactly.
For example.
It's like, could they just be a good company that has a lot of cash and sells a lot of iPhones? Like,
no.
Is that why they're like doing so well? But we even looked at it relative to small caps. So small caps tend to have higher passive ownership than large caps. Small caps have been have lagged for a decade to the S&P. So that refutes it too. There's a lot of things that refuted a lot of the arguments that, you know, some big names have brought up. I think what do people just take it at face value because they're a big name, and it's just been hard to outperform the S&P. And can we get there eventually? Sure. Maybe if it's like 75 or 80% passive ownership, maybe that becomes problematic. But at least right now, it just seems like it's really premature to be blaming passive for a lot of the underperformance.
Worth noting that he's also had pretty good performance during that some of this time.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Couple things on this passive number that are important. Number one is when you look at the stocks that are most owned by passive, passive also includes smart beta. And like, so sometimes active sells off a stock and its price starts to go down, its yield goes up. And there's a lot of dividend, popular dividend ETFs, because investors like yield, whatever. They'll buy that stock. So it ironically, some of the dump stocks by active become passive's favorite because of smart beta. So there is a smart beta factor in that passive number. That's, I think, important to point out. The other thing is, I like the eye test. You know, people...
What's the eye test?
...are going to just... The eye test is this. Tesla... is a great example. It's a big holding the S&P. You just talked about Apple. Tesla's might even be better. It has had a bad run, but then it had a good run. Right after that, when earnings popped back up. NVIDIA was like really nowhere 3-4 years ago. Now it's like a top holding. It's not like index funds decided to make NVIDIA a big deal or decided that Tesla wasn't good. Active decided this. The people trading the stocks bid up Tesla after good earnings. They dump it after bad earnings. So when I see these stocks moving up and down, I don't really, that's the eye test. Someday, if stocks just stop moving, because we're all just one gigantic passive blob, I think the arguments could be stronger. But I think until people can see it or feel it, and certainly their index funds gives them a lot of return over active funds, so they're happy with the outcome as customers, and they don't really see any problem in the market because stocks go up and down, that's a big problem for the worriers. You can't really see it, feel it, or touch it right now. It all looks like it's working fine. So I'm not saying they don't have some points, and deep in those white papers, there are some things we need to look at, but the eye test is pretty compelling that there's no problem.
So the market is not broken?
No. I mean, again, stocks go up and down all over the place. Sometimes small caps are in favor, sometimes large caps. And also, the Fed is a big variable, and so is the options market. There's many things that, quote, distort things. And I just think active, that's the natural state of the market. And there was crashes and surges before index funds were invented, too. So I just don't see this as any really big thing to worry about in general. But Ethan's numbers, I think, were interesting because they sort of helped give some data behind this as well that overturned some of what people like to say. But let me tell you this, Joel. The reason the worriers get a lot of ink is because those articles will do really well. We've tested it. You write something about passive worry, the readerships are amazing. People are going to click on that. If you write like, hey, nothing to worry about here, it's like crickets. So there's definitely a natural inclination to like talk about anything that says there's a worry. And this is why you don't see many studies that go this other direction, because there's really not an incentive readership-wise to put them out.
All right, Ethan, Katie, thanks so much for joining us on Trillions.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber-Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Bye!
Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Invesco QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.